All right. As was mentioned earlier, my name is Christy Trimmer, and this is my co-presenter, Selena Ortiz. And we will be talking about reducing immigrant deaths along the U.S. border, specifically about the role of academic institutions. And I want to add that we have no financial conflicts of interest. Our objectives for the presentation are the following. We are seeking to frame border deaths and immigration in a public health context. And we will also be talking about policies that have contributed to the funnel effect to getting migrants to cross in increasingly perilous areas, as was set up by the first presenter. And finally, we'll talk about the steps to developing a position statement. Selena and I are former student members of a group called the Global Health Alliance, which is a student organization founded at the University of Arizona College of Public Health. And our mission is, you can see here, and as a group of students, we sought to identify an important public health issue in our area of Southern Arizona and identified immigration, particularly the high rates of border deaths in the area, as an issue that we wanted to tackle. And as a result, we hosted a conference with a number of academics and community members presenting their data and the information showing that where we live in Tucson, in the Tucson sector of the border, is the most perilous, most dangerous area of the border to cross, with the largest number of border deaths. As a result of this conference, we created a position statement and went through some advocacy efforts to present that statement to various organizations, which we'll talk more about. So we are going to be framing our own experience and kind of interweaving our own experiences into the broader context of the policies that have caused this problem, as well as what is the role of academic institutions in addressing any kind of issue of concern. First, we wanted to start with framing immigration as a public health concern, which we in public health thought would be pretty intuitive, but we found that there were stakeholders and organizations that didn't believe that immigration was necessarily a public concern. So as our first presenter was mentioning about economic factors, the push-pull factors that cause people to migrate in the first place, there are also political factors, and as we know, our current immigration laws don't reflect the needs that we have economically, or the needs that people have to come and to work. And finally, there are a number of social factors that frame immigration as a public health concern, everything from familial separation to depression and drug use to a change in the demographics of border crossers. It used to be more men, and now seeing increasingly more women and children coming. So this is the context we use to frame immigration as a public health concern. This slide depicts the border region. The border is defined as being 100 kilometers north and south of the line. And specifically, I'm about to present some data that we used as an organization that pertains to the Tucson sector of the border, which runs about the eastern three-quarters of the state of Arizona through here. And the Tucson sector is the most deadly sector of the border for migrants who are crossing. Here are some pictures to show you a little bit about what this region looks like geographically. It's very harsh. This slide is to set up the conditions in which people are crossing, showing the average monthly temperatures is what the middle line is. The top line depicts the average high temperature, and the bottom depicts the average low temperature. So you can see it's very hot in the summer, but it gets surprisingly cold in the winter as well. The following several slides are from a paper that was published by Dr. Raquel Rubio Goldsmith, who was supposed to be the other presenter in this session here, in which she has data too that she has termed the funnel effect, which talks about immigration policies forcing people to cross in more and more perilous regions of the desert, as opposed to former crossing points in urban areas like here in San Diego or in El Paso, as our first presenter was mentioning a bit. And these data show that from the years, it runs from 1990 until the years 2005. And you see here in 1999 a very large increase in the number of bodies recovered in the Tucson sector of the border. And I want to emphasize that this data just shows the bodies themselves that are recovered and is not necessarily indicative of the number of deaths that actually happen in the area. There are migrants who cross and report seeing bodies. There are missing persons reports filed that have no bodies on record to contact. But you can see that there is, in fact, a 20-fold increase is what they term in the paper they identified of the number of bodies found in this area. And this slide shows that this top line, the blue line here, is that the cause of death has been determined to be from exposure, hypo or hyperthermia, as far and away the highest cause of death, as opposed to other causes of death, including motor vehicle accidents and homicide. This slide shows where recovered bodies have been found. That's what the red dots are. And you can see that there are some areas where there are more heavily trafficked corridors where people travel through and where more bodies are found. This slide also shows the blue flags, which are water stations that humanitarian groups have put out in the desert as one way of trying to provide aid to people who are crossing.
Okay, so now we're going to move into looking at more specific policies that impact border migration and deaths, and also just alluding to what Amy spoke on. You know, there's lots of policies happening at the national and the state as well as the local level in Arizona that have increased the number of deaths that we see, unfortunately. Amy talked about Operation Hold the Line, Operation Gatekeeper, and specifically NAFTA, and I just want to just add one more point to that, and that since NAFTA has been in effect, 19 million more Mexicans now live in poverty, more than before NAFTA was in effect. And that's data that we can actually cite and see. So it's not this anecdotal, qualitative perception of what's happening in Mexico. This is really true. Where NAFTA was proposed as a policy that would introduce more economic gain. And I think Amy's right on when she says and identifies exactly who's received the benefits of NAFTA and who we've seen completely ruined by NAFTA. Sometimes we hear that pundits against immigration reform or pundits against undocumented persons will actually say that the economic fault is of Mexico, because around 1993, 1994, the Mexican peso actually decreased in value. Well, that was actually a result of United States labor laws and in regards to NAFTA. So, you know, there's a lot of debate still about, you know, the effect of NAFTA, and that's something that we need to be very considerate of. If you look at the state of Arizona, the Proposition 102 was actually a proposition that passed with about 75% of the vote, and basically it alluded to civil suits in the state of Arizona. And what it meant was that undocumented persons who had been injured in the occupational setting were not able to sue for punitive damages against their employer, who actually had very unsafe occupational hazards. Now, while undocumented persons are able to sue for compensatory damages, what that means in terms of not being able to sue for punitive is that the employer can continue to have these conditions that are detrimental to the occupational health and safety of undocumented persons. And that proposition works very well today, unfortunately. And when we look at tribal, the nation of Tehana Adam is actually right in the southern part of the state of Arizona, and their nation actually goes into Mexico itself. And so there's very little published or explicit knowledge expressed by the nation or the federal government in terms of what border crossing means within the nation. So in other words, you'll even have the Tehana Adam Nation members who are in fact Mexican citizens and can't even cross into their own nation because they're considered illegal immigrants. Which blows my mind away. I think is horrific. So what happened as a result of our conference that we did is that we decided to look at border deaths, as Christy mentioned, within this public health frame. And the first couple of ways we wanted to highlight this was looking at border deaths within public health and the public health effect of migration. And it is a social phenomenon that's occurring. And so right off the bat, that seemed a no-brainer. We also wanted to acknowledge and discuss the root causes of migration. As Christy mentioned, that economic demand for cheap labor here in the United States, as well as economic deprivation in the country of origin, as well as political upheaval and human rights abuses that still continue in many of the countries in which we see a lot of undocumented migrants coming from, that still exist. We also wanted to utilize the human rights language and looked at the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Also the right to migrate and the right to return home. And since these policies have been enacted, that really isn't happening. You're no longer having the coming into the United States and then returning back to the country of origin, you know, for work. So what happens is that there's now more undocumented persons here who really have no choice, you know, to return home because they can't. And then also look at establishing a dialogue regarding the true costs of migration. Judith Gans, who is a researcher at the University of Arizona, published last year a really fantastic report on the economic impact of undocumented migrants in the state of Arizona. And we actually see that the number of dollars that is contributed to the Arizona economy, as well as the federal economy, by undocumented migrants is very substantial. The revenue that's generated in sales tax, also any tax that is a result of property tax, but they can't claim on their own in terms of the tax returns, all that money goes to feed an economic system in which they're not eligible to receive any benefits from. So our proposed border death position statement, given everything that I've mentioned, was the following. The Mellon Enid Zuckerman College of Public Health at the University of Arizona adopts the position that deaths at the border are a serious public health concern and are unacceptable and preventable. So now I want to move into just what happened after we proposed that position statement. Before I get into this slide, what happened was we recognized that we needed buy-in from the entire college, and that consisted of four major groups throughout, including the students, the academic professionals, the staff, and the faculty. It was very important for us to outline exactly what the position statement meant, have a discussion in terms of what it meant in terms of public health, and really kind of the symbolism behind it. Christy and I are we're kind of struggling with, you know, how to report what happened because we care a lot about this. And unfortunately, three out of the four groups that we proposed the proposition statement to approved it, the students, the academic professionals, and the staff. It was the faculty, it was the public health faculty that did not approve the statement. And while there are people amongst the faculty who were big supporters of the position statement and were our champions, the majority of faculty decided that public health is not a political issue. Policy has no place in a school of public health, that we shouldn't be setting policy, and that this just is really out of the realm of what public health does. And we can answer questions about that. to. So what it really meant to, for us as a student organization was that it really was a historic precedent for students to engage in advocacy and policy change at the academic level. So we went beyond the expected role of nice two-year master's in public health students, you know, who just go and collect, you know, immunization data and, you know, all the good stuff. And we actually identified something that needed to be addressed. We found that working with our College of Public Health that there is a paucity of guidelines on the academic roles in advocating for policies. We asked, what's the role of advocacy in public health, since we thought that that was the origin of public health, and social justice being a big part of that. How should advocacy be taught to public health students, and how do we translate advocacy from textbook to practice?
Without any guidelines within our own college of how an issue that is brought up by students, how it should be addressed, how there should be if any sort of formal policy created as the college, we look to the data, the body of literature that's out there, and didn't find a lot of help there either, but did find a lot of information about universities as being important politicizing agents in social movements, and that happens both in times of when there are a lot of issues to be brought up during, say, the 60s civil rights and Vietnam protests, as well as in times when there's not as much, but that there really is an opportunity for action in universities, and that they sort of universities serve as a reproduction of activism in that a cohort of new students comes in and finds an already existing network of students who are there, and they can become involved and sort of perpetuate themselves that way. So as a result of our experiences with developing our own position statement and not having it go anywhere with our own faculty, we wanted to reflect on that and have steps in developing a position statement. And I do want to include also that we went beyond our own faculty and our own college and presented our position statement to a number of local, state, national, and some binational, some international organizations, including the U.S.-Mexico Border Health Commission, the Mexico-Arizona Border Health Commission, and the Arizona Public Health Association, as well, and received great support from them, as well as from some local community action boards. But as a result of our experience, we crafted these steps for developing a position statement. And the first, which we mentioned, about collectively identifying and defining an issue of concern and framing it in a public health context. Thirdly, it's important to identify available resources in these times of short funds. We were just asking people to form committees and to look at what this meant in adopting the position statement. It's also important to understand your stakeholders, not only who might support you, but who might not support you and why. And we were surprised to find that the faculty might not support us and some of the reasons why that we didn't really address ahead of time that might have helped in our effectiveness. Fifthly, effective communication is important for tailoring your message, especially understanding why people might oppose you. Coalition building is important, and sustainability as well is important, and how to keep people interested and engaged over the long haul in issues, in the face of many issues. And I won't go through, in the interest of time, detail by detail, the rest of the steps so that Selena can finish.
Also, just in the interest of time, I just want to point out that one of the reasons why we looked at this issue was at the time House Bill 4437 was being considered, and this is the House bill at the federal level that was actually going to criminalize anybody, including humanitarian aid workers, clergy, or anybody else who had any hand in assisting undocumented persons as criminals. And unfortunately, that this was even considered was a major concern of ours. Fortunately, it really served as a platform for communities to really organize and oppose this this bill. And what this led to then was this discussion about how we need to have large immigration reform. And as Amy mentioned also earlier, unfortunately, neither of the candidates have even mentioned immigration reform in their platform. I'd say the last thing is, don't do all the work yourself. We really had a really strong team to work on this issue. You know, it took a lot of us to work on this, and I don't think if you didn't have that support, we would have burned out a long, long time ago. So we're keeping this sustained. We have new members of GHA at the University of Arizona, and we're really looking forward to seeing, you know, what's going to happen next with this. And our special acknowledgments, so thank you.
Collaborating to address the border issues.